Shop the Sherwin-Williams sale and get 30% off Duration, Woodscapes, and SuperDeck products May 1st through the 11th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
And we're talking about Colour Queens next, because my next guest is Duncan McKay. He's talking about Echolens, a journey in search of Boudicca. Almost 2,000 years ago, Boudicca led the greatest rebellion Britain has ever seen. Within the space of a single blood-soaked year, she united the tribes to deliver blow after blow to the Roman regime. Here to tell us more about it is the author of Echolens, a journey in search of Boudicca, Duncan McKay. Good morning to you, Duncan.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. So let's get this cleared up once and for all, because if you were a schoolboy in the 70s, she was pronounced Boadicea. So how did we get from Boadicea to Boudicca in one foul swoop?
Yes, I was a schoolboy in the 70s, and she was Boadicea to me as well. So yeah, it's the most beautiful rendition of name. It's been the one that's been used for probably well over 100 years. It was actually a spelling mistake when somebody was hand copying a copy of Tacitus, who's the Roman author that gives us the main account. He spells it Boudicca with two C's. So Boudicca. A scribe has miscopied the U as an A, and the second C is an E, which gives you Boadicea or Boadicea.
The Latin version of spell check always let you down, didn't it? Let's face it. What time period are we talking there? Because when people say it's the Romans, I mean, we seem to think that's Julius Caesar and, you know, Pontius Pilate, and that's about it. But we're talking a huge amount of time. So are we talking later Roman Empire stage? Has the Roman Empire disintegrated into Holy Roman Empire and the Western Empire? What's the time frame, Duncan?
This is taking place in the early Roman Empire. So the Romans invaded Britain properly in AD 43, and Boudicca's rebellion took place about 17 years later, somewhere around AD 60. Julius Caesar had been to Britain twice in 55 and 54 BC, so 100 years earlier. But the proper invasion takes place in the mid-first century AD.
So we're talking a period where the Roman Empire is still a force to be reckoned with. Then, I mean, they have invaded, they have subjugated most of the British, you know, the main British Isle, and so this makes Boudicca's sort of achievements even more, if you like, remarkable.
Yes, absolutely. This was the her tribe, the Iceni or the Iceni, had been friends with Rome for about 17 years. They had been disarmed, so they weren't being raised as warriors. And I think anybody in AD 60, there was an entire generation that had grown up knowing nothing but Roman rule. So to be able to raise a rebellion of people who essentially weren't warriors anymore and had been disarmed was quite a feat.
So who was she then? What's her background? Now here we go. Schoolboy knowledge again, which is a little schoolboy history is a dangerous thing. Was she from Essex? I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, she was a fearsome Essex warrior, but where was her tribe? Iceni, Iceni, whatever you want to call them. Where was their stronghold?
A little north of Essex. So mostly we were centred probably on Norfolk. We're probably talking Norfolk, the northern half of Suffolk, and the Cambridgeshire Fens, right, to the eastern part of Cambridgeshire. There was a tribe directly south of them called the Trinovantes who were in Essex. And they were a big part of the story, because we associate the story of Boudicca's rebellion with her and the Iceni. But actually the other tribe that rose with them were the Trinovantes of Essex. What we know of Boudicca is not very much. Mm. She was married to a king called Prasutagus, and he was the king of the Iceni. They had two daughters together, and what seems to have happened is that when King Prasutagus dies, Boudicca becomes sort of the leader. So we do call her Queen Boudica, but really she was a consort of the king, I suppose. But that's about as much as we know about her. We know a lot about what then happened and how she led a war, but yeah, her own personal situation, that's about it.
So what's the spark then? Because I mean, it seems like they're, you know, the tribes are able to have their own kings, have their own queens, live relatively independently, which is how Rome had to basically run its empire, because it was so vast. You couldn't sort of have, you know, you'd have a Roman governor, but you weren't able to crack down on everything, so there had to be a certain amount of autonomy. But what happened to make her rise up, and do we know how she was able to garner these tribes behind her and form alliances with neighbouring tribes?
You're quite right. What the Romans did was they liked people to govern themselves to some extent. But when they invaded a territory, by far the easiest thing was to make friends with, or get tribes to become friends and rule themselves for a little while. They were called client states. So Prasutagus was a client king. That meant that he continued ruling the tribe. The tribe were left by and large in peace and unoccupied. But that arrangement of clientship was with that king and the emperor. Once that king died, that territory would be absorbed into the province, and the property of the wealth of that monarch would become forfeit, and the people were more of a subject people. So what Boudica did when Prasutagus died, she didn't want that to happen. Prasutagus had left a will to the Roman emperor Nero, leaving half of his territory to the emperor and the other half to his daughters. This was really in contravention of that sort of scheme. So the Romans went in and said they wanted the lot. Boudica presumably stood up to them, and that effectively made her a rebel.
And I mean, quite remarkable, because, you know, as I said before, Rome and its army, because that is the ultimate sort of pointy end of Roman policy, to put it mildly. Rome's army is something to be feared. I mean, it's made huge gains throughout the known world at that point, you know, subjugated Germania, etc. So were the Romans in Britain too lax? Were they not expecting such a rebellion, such a force of a rebellion? And as I said before, were the other tribes around thinking, well, hang on a second, if Boudica's doing this, we might as well tag onto it, because we can get our independence as well.
Well, yeah, the Roman army was probably the best army of the ancient world. It was utterly brutal. It was very well-trained, equipped, very well-disciplined. And it had been fighting hard in Britain. There was an ongoing guerrilla war in Wales. And part of the way that this story is building up is that a lot of the Roman soldiers fighting in Wales are fighting a terrible guerrilla war. That each side hates each other. They're not really taking prisoners. It's an ongoing guerrilla war. A lot of those are fairly old soldiers, and they're retiring to Essex, to a town called Camulodunum, which was the first proper Roman town in Britain. But those veterans were going back with a pretty bad attitude, and treating the native Trinovantes in the area very badly indeed. And so they were ripe for rebellion. When Boudica stands up to the Romans in AD 60, the Romans flog Boudica. They rape her daughters, and they start to take the territory by force. So with the Iceni and the Trinovantes next to each other, pretty much the whole of East Anglia, dissatisfied and wanting to end Roman rule, I think it's very easy for her to rouse the neighbouring tribe to rebellion as well. And so they then fall on the city of Camulodunum, which is effectively completely undefended because most of the army is fighting in the west.
Mm. And as for a Roman in Britain at the time, I mean, it's pretty deep. I mean, we tend to say, oh, the poor Romans, they must have been longing for the Tuscan hills, you know, and the beautiful climate. But, you know, Roman civilization in Britain, it was, you know, beautiful villas, quite a nice part of the world, of the UK to be in, wasn't it? So they probably weren't expecting that as they were sort of lolling around one day thinking, what's that on the horizon, as they looked out across their patios.
No, I think they were taken completely by surprise. And Camulodunum, which is now Colchester, it was settled by military veterans. So they were hard men. They had a lot of military experience. They almost certainly were still very heavily armed. Tacitus says that part of the reason for putting veterans in that area was to guard against rebellion. So presumably they're still armed as well. But when they find out that this rebel army is approaching them, they don't evacuate the city. They don't raise defences. They probably have a pretty arrogant attitude that these are just disarmed natives. They're subject peoples. They're little better than slaves. Mm. They can deal with it. They send for military aid and not very much comes, but I think they're probably still initially quite confident that they can see this off. I think when the Acanian, the Trinovantes actually arrive to attack the city and they see the sheer numbers that they're dealing with, which presumably were many thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, even at the beginning, they must have realised that they really had no hope of seeing it off unless military aid could get to them.
Now, you see, the thing is, we get coloured because we don't know that much about her until, obviously, this you've done the book, Duncan. Most of us will therefore have a vision of Boudica that has been coloured by the Victorian historian rewrites and the Pre-Raphaelites, and we're talking sort of half-dressed women on chariots, and it's all very romantic and a whole bits and pieces. But having done, even myself, a bit of research on this particular area, I mean, the retribution dealt out to the Romans was brutal, to put it mildly. We're talking about body parts being sewn onto other body parts, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. That particular detail comes from an author called Cassius Dio, who is writing much later and writes a very dramatized account of Boudica's war. I don't think there's any reason to doubt that massacre took place and terrible, terrible atrocities took place. Dio does specify these particularly unpleasant things where, as you say, body parts are sewn onto body parts.
Well, we're just coming up to 11 o'clock, so I think we can say what body parts were put on what body parts. Don't worry.
Okay, so he says that the noblest Roman women had their breasts sliced off and sewn to their mouths to make them appear as if they were eating them, and that they were then skewered lengthwise on wooden stakes. Now, I don't think we need to doubt that terrible atrocities took place. Whether or not we can accept that from a couple of hundred years later as anything more than an embellishment is another matter. But yes, certainly Tacitus, who's the more reliable author, says that they are massacring everybody and not taking prisoners. She's not unusual for an ancient commander. The Romans did the same when they sacked a city. Ancient warfare was eye-wateringly pitiless and brutal. So she would have been a fairly unusual ancient commander had her army taken lots of prisoners and treated them well. But yes, it was an utterly brutal war.
And yeah. what was the shock rate? So this must have started shock rates down to is it Londinium at this point? I mean, and also to Rome. I mean, didn't they sort of raise the eagle of the ninth and come charging up and suppress Boudica as well?
Well, yeah, the Ninth Legion, who obviously are famous from a later period because of some wonderful books and films about them. At that time, they were stationed in the Midlands. They were stationed, we think, probably the better part of half of the Legion was stationed near Peterborough. So the first thing the veterans do, I should think, is send a message firstly to London to try and get aid from the procurator in London, but also to send a message up to the army. And the closest garrison is probably near Peterborough. And they do march. We're told that perhaps as much as half a legion march to try and save Camulodunum. We are also told that they don't get there. At some point en route, they are presumably ambushed on the line of march. We're told that they were routed and massacred. It doesn't sound like a good battle. So yeah, they never got to the city. So Camulodunum, Colchester fell to the rebels. So
this sounds like, you know, rather than just raising an army and wiping out one particular settlement after what's been meted out to your daughters and who can blame her, etc., that basically this is a coordinated, this is strategy. This isn't a ragtag army of tribes. This is thought out. And ambushing a legion on the column of march. I mean, they may be arrogant, they may be confident, but it still implies that there was an awful lot of sort of strategic strategic thought going into this one.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think one image that we always have of the ancient Britons fighting the Romans is that they're just running with their swords raised in the air, screaming with no coordination. I think what comes from any reading of any of the accounts of the invasion of Britain from Julius Caesar in 55 and 54 BC through to the invasion year of AD 43 is that the Britons were actually very stubborn and very sophisticated on the battlefield. I mean, the entire conquest of Britain from the southern coast up to the highlands of Scotland took 40 years to complete. So it was pretty constant fighting. At least 30 years of that was active campaigning. So, yeah, I think the Britons could be fairly sophisticated on the battlefield and probably had a much wider tactical a skill than we often give them credit for.
And presumably, when she gets this victory, other tribes, she must send out emissaries to other tribes and say, "Look, you know, we got this far. Are you with us? You know, let's get the Romans out and what, presumably march on London." I mean, what's the next? I mean, we don't need to go through the whole book, but presumably because we know of her, she's been, you know, she's the stuff of a legend. Presumably, it inspires an uprising amongst other tribes.
This is a very good question. Tacitus names the Acheni, the Trinovantes, so we know that the east of England rises. He says that others join with them, but he doesn't name them, and that's left a lot of questions over who they might be. It might not have been whole tribes, it may have been factions of other tribes. We know from other examples that some tribes were split. There'd be a ruler who wanted to be friendly to Rome, but factions within it that were very anti that. So it may have been these anti-Roman factions rising up. There doesn't seem to have been a general uprising right across southern Britain, but there are intriguing deposits. What we get in the towns that Boudicca destroyed is a thick burnt layer in the archaeology right at the bottom, where we can date it pretty much to that year and say this is Boudicca's destruction. She says they destroyed three towns, Colchester, London, and then St. Albans, and we find those destructions layered there, the layers there, but we do find burning layers of that era elsewhere, particularly west of London. So whether or not there were local uprisings further afield, we don't know.
I mean, St. Albans, you know, was a major Roman settlement as well, perhaps even, you know, on a par, if not even more than London itself. So these are pretty heavy hits she's putting on the Romans.
Yeah, she falls on London and she utterly destroys that. She then falls on Verulamium, St. Albans, utterly destroys that. And effectively, that's the three big Roman towns gone. In some ways, you could look at the Romans aren't, The Roman army at that time is in North Wales, and while all this is going on, the commander Suetonius Paulinus is marching his army very rapidly back to try and sort this out. But effectively, he has lost the province. He hasn't come down to beat a rebellion. At that point, he's lost the province. All the major three towns have gone, and Boudicca's really in control of that entire southeastern part of the country.
Mm. How do we? Because obviously, we have, even at a distance of a couple hundred years, but there will be contemporary reports from the Romans, obviously going back and forth, you know, from the seat of empire. How do we have any insight into what was going on in Boudicca's court?
None whatsoever. There are two magnificent speeches that have been put into the mouths of Boudicca. One, the very, very long and elaborate one by Cassius Dio at the beginning of the war, and then another one by Tacitus on the eve of the final battle. Sadly, they are both completely made up. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The Dio's particularly is so ridiculous that it would be almost impossible for her to have come out with what he says she said. But I don't think they could have had any insight whatsoever into the thinking behind the war or Boudicca's thoughts or what she said on the eve of the battle, sadly.
So what are we, I mean, this is where the research comes, and I don't mean clicking on a mouse. This is where getting your hands dirty and digging down and seeing the levels. And presumably there are artifacts, because it's not all, if you think about tribes, it's not mud huts and it's not, you know, woad everywhere. I mean, there's sophisticated weaponry. Were there chariots, or is that a Victorian invention?
No, there almost certainly were chariots. I think Caesar talks about facing 4,000 chariots when he came across. They were quite archaic by that time. They weren't using them much on the continent by that time, but Britain seems still to have been using them. there's good. There's a lot of very good evidence for chariots in Britain archaeologically as well. You often find the fittings for chariots, and especially in East Anglia, and especially in Norfolk. So I think even though the Roman descriptions of Boudicca riding in a chariot are to some extent just literary embellishments, it's actually quite a fitting one. It seems that the Iceni really, really were big charioteers.
And it all comes down to a final battle, which is, you know, and this is the, this must be the annoying thing about putting something like this, because you'd be, with archaeology, you can help to get the picture, and with historical research, you help to get the picture, but you can almost put a form to it, but then it sort of just dissipates in the mist.
Yes. There's some amazing archaeology that goes with this story. And we're always torn between whether we rely on the historical authors, whether we rely on the archaeology, and how safe it is to tie those two together. I think with Tacitus's account in the annals, we have a very, very good and accurate solid campaign narrative. And the archaeology that we find in the towns seems to back him up at every step of the way. So if we only had the historical account, or if we only had the archaeology, we'd be scrambling a little bit. But I think if we combine the both together, they do fit very well. The problems are there are big questions left open where we don't have a lot of archaeology and there's not much in the historical account, or it's a bit ambiguous. So once we get to St. Albans and London and that area, we're not quite so sure what the armies were doing. Tacitus says that Suetonius Paulinus and the Roman army got to London before Boudicca. So they must have marched very hard and very quickly, or Boudicca was taking the time. They found it indefensible. They abandoned it. Boudicca came in behind them and destroyed it. They then say that the like ruin fell on the town of Verulamium. So Boudicca clearly marches north and destroys St. Albans. But we don't know what Paulinus and the Roman army was doing. We assume that he fell back north to Verulamium, abandoned it, and then she destroyed it. But then we know that they had a battle. They had one of probably the biggest battle ever to take place on British soil. And really, there's been a lot of map gazing and field walking and for over 100 years trying to work out where that battle might have been. And that's always been the great mystery of this story.
One of the great things about military tactics is you draw your enemy to the ground where you know you can beat them. So perhaps the Romans were falling back until they got exactly the right place where they could inflict a defeat upon her army.
That is exactly what Tacitus tells us, yes, that he had a big army. I mean, he had an army of about 10,000 men, so I don't think he was running scared, but that's the right. Boudicca may have had many tens of thousands of warriors, maybe 100, 120,000 by some accounts. So he is outnumbered, but he's got a good army, so he doesn't, I don't think he has to cross the country to try and find a decent battlefield. Tacitus describes the position that he chose, and it seems that he had a position that was backed by woodland, so he couldn't be outflanked by the Britons. They couldn't come and secretly take him from behind. They had to approach him through a landscape feature that channeled them towards him. We call it a defile. We assume it's some sort of shallow, relatively narrow valley that would channel the Britons to his position. That puts the Britons at an immediate disadvantage. They can only attack him from one direction, and because they're being channeled, he can block the end of that defile, and he's giving them a very limited front on which they can attack. So effectively, their numbers not only don't give them an advantage, but it plays against them, because they're channeled and they're going to be crushed and bottlenecked. Mm. And he says that the Britons were approaching from relatively clear ground. If you look at an Ordnance Survey map, you'll find dozens of sites that could really be pushed to look like that. So that's always been the problem. Where was this defile?
So what led you to write this? Is it to sort of blow away the cobwebs? I mean, she's sort of in people's consciousness, even if their knowledge of Roman or British history is, oh yeah, you know, Boadicea, of course, you know, warrior queen, the statue of her half clothed outside the Houses of Parliament or whatever, isn't it? So, I mean, was that the reason you wanted to do this book? Because it's like, look, this is actually, we can do the research, we can do the digging, we've got a better idea now, and it's time to dispel a lot of the myths about her.
Yeah, I mean, this is a book I've wanted to write for decades. And I remember talking to a friend about following in the footsteps of Boudicca and the War about 30 years ago and never got round to it. But as my background is very much is archaeology, but very much sort of digging archaeology and landscape research and landscape survey. And I think a lot of archaeologists and historians will recognize the sentiment that although library research and book research is wonderful and enjoyable and absolutely essential, at the end of the day, there's nothing like taking that research out into the landscape and trying to, you know, match it there and actually see these sites. So, yeah, I wanted to go on a journey across Britain as I'd always wanted to, starting in Boudicca's home territory, which is where I live, and then follow her route across Britain, and also to look at the Roman army and follow their route, and to try and come up with an idea of where they might have met, and looking at all the archaeology on the way. We've found so much that relates to this war and sometimes might relate to the war or to that period. I wanted to put it all together and tell the most complete version of the story that I think you could give. But also, wars and campaigns happen in landscapes, and the way those landscapes lie, the roads that run through them, the way the valleys all join up and where rivers are is so important in a campaign that I think to really get a feel for it, you can stare at maps for hours, but ultimately you need to go to those places and actually see the landscape.
And the fascinating thing is we're talking about a time 2,000 years ago. And yet, there, as you say, there are echoes, because the book is called Echolands, that you can find echoes, you can find proof that actually, you know, draw back the mists of time and it's there right in front of you.
Yeah, we live on the same landscapes. And I think that's what always drew me to this. This isn't some long lost ancient epic from half a world away. We still live in the same towns. We still use the same roads. Sometimes the train lines that we use run directly along the lines of Roman roads. It's all there. And often the landscape hasn't really changed. I mean, yes, the some of the towns are bigger. They look very different. Obviously, you stand in the city of London and try to imagine the daub and thatch and mud brick town that was there in Boudicca's time. It feels like that would be very difficult, but actually I find that quite easy. It's about the location and the landscape, and the Thames is still the Thames. It's still flowing where it flowed. And I think if you can just stand and take a moment of still mental silence, you actually can begin to reimagine it. And once you get out into the country, that the countryside is superficially changed with pylons and hedgerows, but it's the same landscape. They're the same contours. They're the same rivers.
The book is called Echolands, A Journey in Search of Boudicca. It's by Duncan Mackay. Duncan, if people want to find you online, where can they track you down?
I'm on Twitter, and I'm at the Duncan Mackay. And the book itself is available in hardback and ebook and audiobook as well.
And available as a download from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Echolands, A Journey in Search of Boudicca. It's by Duncan Mackay. Duncan, thank you so much for your time today.
Brilliant. Thank you, Charles. It was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.